Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home, hello Mama Africa, how are you, I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too, hello Mama Africa, how are you, I hope when you hear these words, your grace turn blue, grace turn blue.
To another edition of Your World News, where we provide you news and information and insight and critical analysis that you simply will not find from the mainstream Western corporate media. And as always, I say it every week, but we got another fantastic edition today, another fantastic episode, and a lot of that hinges on the fact of based around who our guest is. We're going to have a very special guest today, Lynn Washington, who is a journalist, activist. He's trained in the field of law. He started working on the becoming involved in the Mumia trial right when it first started back in 1971. He been covering things like the raid on the Move House in 78 and 84, 85, and just a number of things. And so we're really fortunate to have him on the show today. We've been working on this interview for quite some time, and just based on schedules, it wasn't it wasn't permissible in past weeks, but we finally had schedules on both ends opened up, and so he'll be joining us today, and probably about half past this hour. But once again, I'm joined by one of our celebrity activist co-hosts, Peter Fowler, who's joining us from Glendale, Arizona, and also fortunate to have Peter join us on this interview. You know, he'll be breaking down a lot of the news and information that we're going to feature on this show, and as well as interviewing and having a nice dialogue with Lynn Washington. So I believe Peter's on the line. Peter, are you there?
Right here, Sol. Good to be with you, bro.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. So much to talk about in so little time. It's amazing how a 120-minute show just is not enough, and that speaks to the volume of what the corporate media leaves out. And this is, to me, that I see this as a public service for myself, and I know Peter still feels the same way, to do what we can. You know, we're not getting any commercial funding or anything like that, but to really use this platform, you know, this internet-based platform, to provide you guys information that you may or may not already have. But the important thing is that, you know, we can send these kind of links off to all of our networks and friends and family and colleagues and so forth. And it may be a dose of reality that they're not ready for. But, you know, as we know, with all good natural medicine, it does the body good, and this does the mind right, because we can't even think about trying to make a difference if we don't have an educated populace in terms of what's going on. And so that's the intro, and I want to start off, because I want to cover a couple of clips that I think are pretty salient to what's going to be discussed with Brother Lynn Washington when he comes on the show. And so I want to, you know, as usual, start off with a couple of clips from one of my favorite online periodicals, and that's Black Agenda Report, and you know, Brother Glenn Ford breaking down his commentary on a couple different things that are definitely newsworthy. May not be to the corporate Western media, but for those of us who try to, you know, seek real change, these are very important news clips. And so I want to start off with this. I think it speaks volumes to itself. And on the other end, Peter and I will join you if at any time you want to call in. The number is 347-945-5191. Once again, the number is 347-945-5191. And here's clip number one.
When Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in September 2005, it unleashed a tidal wave of police violence against that city's black citizens. One particularly vicious gang of at least seven cops converged on the Danziger Bridge over the Industrial Canal, apparently in search of black people to kill during the post-storm confusion. The officers encountered an unarmed family of five and a friend walking across the bridge on their way to a supermarket, and opened fire on them, seriously wounding four and killing one. Then the cops went to the other side of the bridge and came upon two brothers on their way to a family member's dental office. The cops killed one of the brothers, who was mentally disabled. When they were finally finished shooting, the cops put their criminal minds together to concoct a cover story and plant a weapon on the scene. Last week, a police lieutenant pleaded guilty to his role in covering up the police rampage. The federal conspiracy charges only carry a maximum 5-year prison term and a $250 fine. The seven officers involved in the shootings were all originally indicted on state murder and attempted murder charges back in 2006. But a judge found that prosecutors had acted improperly in preparing the evidence and threw out the case, leaving further action up to federal authorities. Now, the 5-year statute of limitations is due to expire in August or September for the Danziger Bridge shootings and at least 5 other cases of New Orleans cops running amok. One involves the death of a black man 4 days after Katrina hit. The victim, Henry Glover, was shot, probably by police. Later, Glover's friend sought medical assistance from a group of cops who set upon the black men, beat them, then drove off in Glover's car with the wounded man in it. Weeks later, Glover's car and body were discovered incinerated near a levee in the Algiers section of New Orleans. It is, in many cases, difficult to separate New Orleans police lawlessness from the murderous white civilian vigilantism that rocked parts of the city in the wake of Katrina. The white reign of terror is meticulously documented in A.C. Thompson's investigative report, Katrina's Hidden Race War, published in The Nation in December 2008. Police and other officials didn't even bother to keep track of black bodies. New Orleans Parish Coroner Frank Minyard told Thompson that he'd simply chosen not to autopsy some 25 to 50 corpses. For 25 years before Katrina, New Orleans was run by a black mayor and mostly black city council. Yet, in all that time, more than a generation, the city's black leadership failed to create an environment in which black lives were treated as having value. Clearly, there is something wrong with the African-American leadership model when, after a quarter century of black administration, the police force remains so racist at its core it descends into barbarity at the first opportunity, turning New Orleans into a killing field for its black citizens. It's not just New Orleans. Not one black-led major city can claim that it has substantially eradicated institutionally racist policing. Apparently, that's not a priority of the black misleadership class. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And you can catch Black Agenda Report every Wednesday. You know, it's up all week, of course, but they have fresh new stories each Wednesday. So please, definitely, if you're not familiar with it, please tune in to blackagendareport.com. It's a very, very, very important news journal. But I want to, you know, take a quick stab at this, Peter. This, you know, Glenn brings up so many huge points, you know, looking at what's going on in New Orleans, or what has been going on in New Orleans, and this egregious miscarriage of justice. But this is what America does. This is why white supremacy and institutional racism are woven into the fabric of America, so interwoven into the fabric of America that you don't even, you know, this kind of story is just maybe it's a blip on the radar of most mainstream media outlets. You know, I didn't hear any kind of coverage of this whatsoever in any of the you know, the 4 or 5 major, or I guess the 4 major news outlets in the U.S. You know, NBC, CBS, ABC, MSNBC, and of course not on the white supremacist Fox News. But this is what America does. This is what makes it so institutional. In terms of police brutality, white supremacy, institutional racism, is that these things continue to go on. And he's damn right. Glenn Ford is exactly right on once again with his analysis that, you know, black leadership in this country has not pressed elected officials. And I can't say all black leadership, because there are some black elected officials who have brought this up, but by and large, you know, when you look at the Congressional Black Caucus, this is not something that they press. Every fall they have the CBC, you know, week or weekend, and it's all this pomp and circumstance, and no national agenda, especially no national agenda presented to President Barack Obama in terms of a list of things that the black community wants to see his administration deal with and face and work towards mitigating and eradicating. Nothing like that. And so, of course, you know, we have this corporate president. Of course, he's not going to deliver on that. But you know, the point of this that I'm talking about, Peter, is that police brutality and police murder, these things are as American as apple pie. They are as American as apple pie, and they continually happen to this day. You know, it's not just the ones that we might hear about here and there, the Sean Bells, Amadou Diallos, you know, Oscar Grant, Adolph Grimes. You know, those brothers lost their lives unwarrantedly because of rogue, you know, institutionally racist cops. And I don't care if, you know, a couple of the cops in the Sean Bell, you know, shooting were black. You can have a black person be sucked up into a racist system where he or she starts to exact the same kind of racist policy and practices as you would have a apparently racist white cop. And so this is what makes it so disgusting, is that it continues to happen and it continues to be unchecked. And I don't know if you have any comments, Pete.
Absolutely. You know, you're right. Glenn made a lot of good points in that clip, and there's a lot of things to unpack, which we don't have time for all of them, obviously. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, he started off the clip talking about manufacturing consent and so forth, and the fact that much of this has been ignored by the mainline media is obvious. You know, the fact that this racially motivated police violence has been ignored by the mainline media. We don't hear about these stories. And then when we do hear about them, it's years later, and we find out, you know, that, you know, guys, these police get away with murder, literally get away with murder, and, you know, either get a slap on the wrist or their cases are tossed out on technicalities and those kind of things. And then the mainline media has the audacity to put, you know, the New Orleans Saints on the front page of the newspaper and say, well, they won a football game, so the city is healed and everything is well in New Orleans, everybody's happy. You know, and so, you know, we're supposed to swallow that mess and believe that, oh, everything's fine, you know, because their football team is good. You know, what a bunch of, you know, just such propaganda. And you know, we have to be able to cut through all the crap and recognize it for what it is, that it is propaganda, and forget about the Saints, forget about football games and basketball games, and look to the streets and see where people's lives are being taken from them, literally taken from them. You know, and the fact, like you said, you know, the idea of rogue cops, it's not about rogue cops. It's not about a bad apple. It's about the existence of a structural corruption, a system that is designed to perpetuate this kind of violence, both physical violence and non-physical violence, like economic violence and so forth, social violence, on particularly people of color, low-income people in our major cities. You know, and I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, which boasted the first black mayor of a major American city. Carl Stokes was elected mayor of Cleveland in 1967. Yet and still, look where Cleveland is today. You know, and it's not because Carl Stokes wasn't a good politician, not because he wasn't a sincere individual. He was a high class person. You know, if there was any higher quality person for the job, I don't know who that could have been. But yet and still, because the system is designed to prey on the citizens of the underclass, people of color, low-income people, Cleveland continues to be a living hell in the central city of Cleveland. You know, and that's the case all around the country, and it's only getting worse. So, you know, I think, you know, we've talked about how we need to keep Haiti in front of us. Same thing, we need to keep New Orleans in front of us. We can't let these cities and the unfolding disasters out of our sights just because time passes after Katrina or time passes after an earthquake. But we have to stay on top of these things and realize that this stuff is unfolding. You know, the real disasters are unfolding on the streets every day.
Right. And we can't let mainstream American institutions, whether that may be mainstream media or just mainstream government in general, dictate our issues, which issues are important, which issues that we need to place in front of us, because that's exactly one of the major roles of the corporate media is that they do work in conjunction with American government, in which they dictate what issues the populace within America has at the forefront of their consciousness or their political consciousness or what have you. And that's why you have a very dumbed down populace in contrast to folks that are outside of the U.S. that really understand a lot of critical issues that are going on, you know, on the ground in the U.S. much more than your average America. So we can't allow, especially things of this nature, where as you said, Pete, as I said, as what Glenn said, as what so many people have said for a long, long time, it's unacceptable. How many young black and brown skinned men, you know what I'm saying, and women for that matter, have to be killed unwarrantedly by the police, over and over again, and they dress it up and they somehow make it, you know, sound as if it was warranted. If this, you know, I thought he was reaching for this or this, that, and the other. You know, what warrants a police murder? What the hell warrants a police murder? These questions are not asked. They're not checked. You don't see these kind of police killings occur in even poor white communities. You just simply don't. But they happen all the time in black and brown communities, especially those that are economically at odds with this capitalist system that we live under. And so, you know, we simply cannot allow them to dictate what issues that we put in the forefront, because this is something where people's lives literally are continually hanging on the balance. Me as a black man, I could easily, you know what I'm saying, easily be Sean Bell. I could easily be Oscar Grant. You know, and that's why I like the fact that so many people said, you know, came out and said, I am Sean Bell, I'm Oscar Grant. They had the T-shirts out, because for real, it's very, very much true. It's not something that preys on people based on, you know, socioeconomic status. It preys on them because of their skin color. Because of their skin color.
Think about Katherine Johnson. Katherine Johnson in Atlanta. This was a 92-year-old woman.
Right.
The Atlanta police broke into her home and murdered her. You know, of course, they cooked up some story, you know, and brought in some stoolies, and you know, this is a 92-year-old woman.
Right.
You know, so you're right. So you're right. It's you know, the threat is real. You know,
yep.
it's a real threat. You know, and
yep.
And it's events like Katrina and the aftermath of Katrina, where the media again creates this image that the black criminality is about to overtake the city again, and so, you know, so the authorities have a license to, you know, shoot to kill. I mean, literally.
Exactly.
I mean, they literally said that we will shoot to kill. You know, those were the
exactly.
words. I don't remember what who said that, but you know, whether it was the governor, the mayor, whatever. But you know, those are the kind of excuses, the justifications for that.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, we can't accept that. We cannot, and that's the kind of thing is to always challenge that. You know, we cannot accept that kind of fraudulent justification for blatant race-based violence.
Exactly, and that's why our organization is so important. Even, you know, our brown-skinned Latino brothers, you know, cases like Seth Williams and the subsequent frame-up around that case. These are important things, and so the question is that how do we, you know, build a better mousetrap. How do we continue to mobilize and organize around these issues and continue to put pressure? And I really, if this is kind of new for you folks that are listening online right now, whether it's live or on archive, definitely go to YouTube and then just type in Katrina's Hidden Race War, and you'll see the 10-minute video footage of this that was done by The Nation magazine, and it gets into those, you know, racist white scumbags in Algiers that, you know, these so-called vigilantes that took up arms and were shooting, literally shooting, you know, black men who came into their neighborhood who were seeking refuge after Katrina. And, it speaks volumes. I mean, they caught them on camera, and they were very, very open about their racism. And it's, as I speak, it kind of really boils my blood, but you know, I really encourage anybody who doesn't really, has never seen it, go to YouTube and just type in Katrina's Hidden Race War. And I want to get to this this clip before we have Brother Lynn Washington coming on in about 5 minutes. This is another very important, and it has so much to do with as we know, there's not any major issue in America that doesn't have intersectionalities. And so this one has intersectionalities that run through it based on race, based on poverty, based on a number of things, even the prison industrial complex.
President Obama's endorsement of the firing of an entire faculty and staff of a Rhode Island public school is reminiscent of Ronald Reagan's crushing of the Air Traffic Controllers Union nearly three decades ago. Back then, President Reagan made an example of a union that had supported his presidential candidacy, firing its members and ultimately decertifying the union when it went on strike. The move sent a signal to the bosses in all sectors of the U.S. economy. The president, the U.S. government, is on management side, and unions are considered a threat to the general economic welfare. Last week, President Obama sent the same kind of signal to teachers' unions when he cited the Central Falls, Rhode Island school shutdown as an example of the accountability he's demanding of poorly performing schools, which invariably means poor, non-white schools. Teachers' union leaders appeared to be shocked by Obama's language and tone, but they shouldn't have been. The Rhode Island's mass firing was not substantively different than the wholesale sacking of teachers and abrogation of their union contracts elsewhere in the country. The fundamental logic of Obama's so-called Race to the Top program, a multi-billion-dollar competition to show which states are most willing to fire teachers, shut down classrooms, and replace them with charter schools, is to break the teachers' union. If the teachers want to save their union, their dignity, their contracts, and the institution of public education, they will have to break with Obama, because he is going after them with a hatchet, just like Reagan went after the air traffic controllers, despite their having supported his 1980 candidacy. Obama's hatchet man and basketball buddy is Education Secretary Arne Duncan, who envisions waves of school closings, teacher firings, and charter school openings for the next 5 or 6 years. That sounds like a kind of final solution for teachers' unions and for public education. Obama's plans for America's classrooms are even more aggressive than George Bush's policies. Obama takes Bush's No Child Left Behind scheme to its logical blood-on-the-floor conclusion, corporate education without the encumbrances of organized teachers. Obama's anti-union vision is more ambitious than that of the old arch-reactionary Ronald Reagan, who destroyed a union of only 13,000 members. The American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association have combined memberships of over 4 million. They have the capacity to fight back, to make this president back off. But like so many others who drank the Obama Kool-Aid, they are in denial, refusing to believe that they backed a union buster who's making teachers the scapegoat for America's historical failure to serve the educational needs of all its children. Private teacher training outfits are turning out young and hungry replacements for today's teachers, anticipating a huge turnover in public schools as Obama swings his hatchet. Teachers need to revolt against this administration while they still have a union to fight for them. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And we'll get back to that clown and, what Obama and his minions are doing in regards to education. But right now, we're joined by Brother Lynn Washington, who I just want to briefly introduce, and I'll let him, give a more formal introduction of himself. He's an associate professor of journalism at Temple University. He's been a long time, first and foremost, I would say, first and foremost, he's been a committed activist within the community, and has done a number of really tremendous things for the public in the community of Philadelphia. As I said before, he became involved in the Mumia case since the day of his arrest. He was arrested December 9th, 1981. He's covered the move situation since late 1975, and that includes the subsequent raids on the move house, where they literally at one time, you know, dropped a bomb on the house, knowing that there are women and children in that house, and we're gonna get into that. He's a columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune, and for those of you guys who know your history, Philadelphia Tribune is the oldest Black-owned newspaper in the United States. He writes extensively about race, racism, and the criminal justice system. As we were just talking, we have something called the prison industrial complex, which is definitely one of the most inherently white supremacist and institutionally racist organs of the United States of America. He covers the news media and society, and this is the kind of progressive journalists and journalism that we need to support. So it's my pleasure to have brother. I call him brother because he, you know, without a doubt, is someone that I definitely look up to in terms of the good work he's been doing for well over three decades, and that's Lynn Washington. Lynn Washington, welcome to the show. I'm Solomon. As you know, we've been communicating a lot via email lately, but we're also joined by my co-host, Peter Fowler, who's joined us live from Glendale, Arizona.
Oh, good evening, sir. How are you? To both of you, and it's a pleasure to be on your show. And I guess I should say, since, you know, we talk about 30 or 40 years of work, that I'm not on Social Security and I don't walk with a cane, so...
that's good, and by the fact that you know you're of a certain age and you're a black man in America, you are that's something to tip your hat to as well, because you know we're an endangered species in this country by design.
Absolutely, yes.
So I just wanted to kind of start off the interview with, I guess, something that we have a common friend, Sabrina,
yes.
who heard you speak in Philadelphia, I believe last month, and I kind of want to go with recent news first, but she was telling me that there's a situation that you've been covering and working on where there's a Haitian man who is being railroaded by the system, and I don't know the specifics or the details of that case, but if you could kind of elucidate that for myself and our listeners, I'd appreciate that.
Okay. it's like, you know, which Haitian man is being railroaded? I've over the last couple of years, I've done a lot of work about a Haitian activist in Philadelphia named Ernest Ford, and he was beaten horribly by the police during a demonstration, ironically, against the police choking a man to death. And he was railroaded through the system. There's photographic evidence of him receiving a vicious beatdown by the police, but he was convicted of assault. But I think the case that our common friend was referencing on Pennsylvania's death row, which has, I think, the fourth largest death row in the United States. You know, think about this. The state of Pennsylvania, with its aura of a Quaker and peaceful tradition, has the largest death row in the Northeast, and one I think the death row there is in Pennsylvania is even more racially discriminatory than in many of the southern states. So that says a lot about the ingrained and institutional racism in Pennsylvania. But this particular gentleman, this Haitian gentleman who was on death row, is again yet another victim of police brutality. He worked, had a job. He was on his way home one night, got into a hack cab. Unbeknownst to him, the hack cab was under observation by some police officers for alleged involvement in some drug dealings. And the police rolled up on the guys, started beating them, and you know, the man fought back in self-defense, and one of the policemen ended up dead. And, you know, now this guy's on death row. So, you know, these injustices happen so frequently. They would be the rule and not the exception in America. And one of the conceptions that we have in America of, you know, equal justice and fairness, it's a farce when it applies to people of color. And actually, when we look at it, when it applies to anyone making less than $250,000. So I think that's the case that your friend was talking about.
Yeah, that's right. Does he have folks that are working with him right now to try to beat this trumped up rap?
No, unfortunately, he's one of these persons who languish on death row without much attention at all. Unfortunately, this is not a case where there's DNA involved, so you don't have the Innocence Project types involved
right.
with it. And there's such a multiplicity of persons who are falsely incarcerated. I mean, you could literally have an army of attorneys and journalists and, you know, interested people working on it, and you still wouldn't be able to get to everybody. And that goes to the core of what you mentioned a few minutes ago about this prison industrial complex, which is really, you know, a form of neo-slavery. And don't even let me say neo-slavery. I was reminded yesterday in listening to another radio program that the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which nominally abolished slavery, permits slavery when it is a product or when it is, you know, utilized in conjunction with someone being convicted. So if you read the Constitution of the United States, you can have slavery as long as the person's convicted. And that can open up a whole other, you know, line of conversation, but I'll stop there.
Right, yeah, you're right, and that's where, you know, human beings become commodities, and when you have something like that on the stock market on Wall Street, clearly it behooves them to have those private prisons filled to the gut with a labor force, you know, and to basically sell that labor off to the likes of everything from Tommy Hilfiger to Eddie Bauer to Dell to Microsoft, you know, and it just saves them a lot of overhead and having to not ship these, you know, these sweatshop factories that they own in Southeast Asia and Central
mm-hmm.
America and so forth. And
right.
you're right.
But, you know, there's one, there's a number of things, but one thing about this prison industrial complex that I think kind of flies under the radar and a little too far under the radar. Why do we have these prisons way out in the boondocks? I mean, if you go down, what is that, Route 60, not Route 66, Route 63, whatever, the one that cuts through the mountains going in out through western Maryland into West Virginia, you know, you drive down there far enough, you run into a place where they have two or three prisons. You know, you can see the sign from the side of the road. You can't see the prisons. But my
right.
point is they put these prisons out in these remote areas, and it really becomes a job program for the people who live there. So you have these all-white staffs managing predominantly black and Hispanic residents. But there's not only does it provide jobs, here's the real dig. Because they have minorities in these communities, albeit minorities who are incarcerated, they get financial aid from the federal government based on indigency, you know, that there's a certain number of the population in a particular county is below the poverty level or whatever. Well, these prisoners who are poor inflate the rate of poverty in those areas such that they get more federal money than they deserve. And it also impacts voting because although these people are incarcerated and cannot vote, their heads are counted, so these rural counties get more representation in the state legislatures. So it's really a scam and a shame. But that's just the way it rolls here in America.
Yeah, you're right. And what's also interesting is that's the way it rolls here in America. And but yet you have all these you know, so-called, you know, black intellectuals, and you and I have had a couple conversations about folks that carry that title so proudly,
yes.
those mm-hmm. those folks signing this you know, this letter to talk about the issue of race and racism in Cuba, and but yet right here in America, you know, which has a much higher rate of incarceration of black people than does Cuba, mm-hmm. and you know, even higher than the rate of incarceration of black men at the height of the apartheid, you know, government in South Africa, but yet
right.
they want to spend their time, you know, instead of, you know, pressuring, you know, this government and this Congress to make a change. But, you know, it goes along with, I guess, since we have a black president and since, you know, many of those folks, you know, it's beyond, or it's well beyond them to actually question this guy and his administration in any shape, form, or fashion. So therefore, I guess they're not going to question their government. So.
Well, that raises, you know, some very tactical and strategic errors on the part of black leadership. We have historically raised certain issues of fairness and equity and equality, you know, lack of discrimination and those sorts of things, opportunities that were denied. And if we keep quiet regarding the Obama administration, then where's the moral legitimacy when somebody else replaces him? And they're going to replace him either in 4 years or now, what, 2.5 years, or in another 4 years, you know, 7 years. So, you know, we have to continue to fight that fight. From my perspective, you know, Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, you know, Bishop Henry McNeil Turner in the 19th century.
Yes.
I mean, these men and women didn't fight to get to the place where we are now, where we're just going to, like, sit down and accept anything because we got a brother in the White House who's looking out for everybody else but us.
Exactly. Yeah. I couldn't have said it better myself. And when you mentioned black activists, you know, someone that jumps to my mind right now that's close in proximity to you and close to you in general, because you've met him and you've been covering his case since 71, and that's Mumia Abu-Jamal, who
yes.
without a doubt is one of the strongest brothers and has provided me with a great deal of inspiration and knowledge, even behind bars. You know, I've kept up with his prison radio commentaries. And I think Peter had a question that we were mulling over. That Peter, I guess you can ask him the next question related to Mumia.
Yeah, thanks, Solomon. Now, Mr. Washington, Peter Fowler from Glendale, Arizona. I want to say hello to you and tell you it's an honor to have you on the show and to be able to dialogue with you. I just commend you on the years of hard work that you've put in exposing the sins of America, particularly with regard to the prison industrial complex and the judicial system in this country.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my experience has been in corrections. I've worked as a chaplain and in community-based corrections and diversion programs with at-risk teens and post-release mentoring programs and so on and so forth. So this is an issue close to my heart as well. Let me ask you this question. Just for our listeners who aren't familiar with Mumia and his case, could you just talk a little bit about that case? I know for a lot of activists, Mumia is the symbol, he's the face of the racist criminal justice system. You know, for folks who aren't familiar with that case, could you talk a little bit about that, particularly what the media leaves out, you know, the propaganda that refuses to talk about the truth behind the case, and your involvement with that case, please.
Okay. That's a lot, but I think I can congeal it down in not 10 words or less, but a little more. Mumia Abu-Jamal is currently one of the 200-plus persons languishing on death row in Pennsylvania. What makes Mumia unique, and let me be clear, his case and the injustices, either, you know, structural, procedural, legal, whatever you want to lay it on, they're not unique to his case because they apply to cases all around the country, be it in Georgia or Missouri or California or whatever. But what makes Mumia unique is that he, before his incarceration, he was an award-winning journalist. Since his arrest on December 9th, 1981, and subsequent to his conviction in 1982, this man has published 5 award-winning books while on death row. This man has authored over 1,000 radio commentaries and broadcast commentaries. He has given college commencement speeches from his death row cell. He's an honorary citizen of cities from San Francisco to Paris to Copenhagen, Denmark. And he is the subject of appeals appealing to the U.S. government to just grant him a fair trial. If he's guilty as charged, then a fair trial will get it. And what happened in 1982 is that there was not a fair trial. There was a trial before a judge who, on the eve of the trial, was overheard saying that he was going to help the prosecutors fry the nigger. Okay? This is in 1982. Not 1882 or 1782, but 1982. So what happened was this. Abu Jamal was convicted of killing a Philadelphia police officer. He's alleged to have been in quite by coincidence, in an area where he observes his brother being beaten by a Philadelphia police officer. He comes to intervene. Shots are fired. He's critically wounded by a shot from the police officer's gun. And it is alleged that he shoots the police officer. Now, the reality is that the evidence against him, be it ballistics evidence, be it eyewitness evidence, or be it confessional evidence, is all circumstantial. And it is riddled with so many holes, if you slice it up and put it on bread, it would be Swiss cheese. Let me give you a case in point. They said, well, Abu Jamal was found at the scene with a gun, and the gun had 5 spent shells in it. Well, nobody checked to see if the gun was recently fired. No one gave him the hand paraffin test to see if there were gunshot residue on him. And none of the bullets that was recovered from the police officer was able to be conclusively matched to his gun. The confession. 2 police officers said that they heard Abu Jamal confess. But an interesting thing happened with this confession. The police officers did not reveal hearing this confession until 2 months after his arrest. And during a probe by the district attorney's office and the police department into a police brutality complaint that Abu Jamal had filed, claiming that police beat the stuffings out of him at the scene of the crime and in the hospital emergency room, all of a sudden these police officers, these 2 police officers, remembered hearing the confession. One of the police officers, on the day of the incident, literally 3 hours after the crime, filed a police report, an official report, saying that the Negro male made no comment. He, 72 days later, all of a sudden remembers that he hears the confession, and when he was interviewed by police, by detectives, and they said his name was Gary Wakeshaw, they said, yo, Gary, you initially said that the Negro male made no comment. Now you're saying that he confessed. Fess up. Tell us what happens here. And in the, I mean, you know, it's almost comical in recounting this, but the courts have upheld it and said everything's fine with it. So when the detective said, you know, tell us, explain to us, you know, this disparity between what you said on December 9th and what you're now saying in February of 1982, and the guy's response was, what he said really upset me, and you know what? I never realized that it had any importance until today. Now, stop for a minute. Let's just stop for a minute. We have a veteran police officer telling other veteran police officers that he didn't realize the importance of a confession from a person accused of murdering a police officer right away. That just defies logic. Confessions are important to at least 2 groups of people, right? Priests, you know, confessional priests, and cops. I mean, please. You know, but this is the type of evidence that has put this man on death row where he has been for the last 27, 28 years. And,
yeah.
So that's the Abu Jamal case.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I get a little passionate about this because, you know, I mean, there's so many facts and figures and layers on this stuff. And, and you just say, you know, how and why? How is this happening? But when you look at cases all around the country, you see the same pattern of things. You see misconduct by judges. You see misconduct by prosecutors. You see misconduct by police. And you see a poor defense lawyering, you know, which is technically called ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, in different cases, these four areas have different levels of weight, but you generally see these same patterns in all of the cases. Last summer, last July, the NAACP at its national convention, the centennial convention, 100 years of the NAACP, they issued a resolution calling on the Obama Justice Department to conduct civil rights investigations into four cases. One was that of Mumia Abu-Jamal. One was Troy Davis, the guy on death row down in Georgia. And then there were two other cases that most people have never heard anything about, including me, you know, and I try to stay up on a lot of this stuff. One is a guy named Reggie Clemens out in Missouri, and the other guy is he's from Baltimore. I always forget his name. I remember it. But he was a Black Panther arrested in the
Eddie 70s. Conway.
Eddie Conway, yes. God, Marshall Eddie Conway. And they said that, you know, there are serious fundamental problems in all four of those cases. To date, I don't think Attorney General Holder or what's that guy in the White House? Oh, Obama. I don't think either of those two gentlemen, and I say that loosely, I don't think either of those two gentlemen have responded to this very mild request that goes to the core of the quality of justice in America. I mean, if we're going to spend $1 million a year to place one soldier in Afghanistan, yeah, to ostensibly bring democracy to that country, why can't we have democracy here when the billions that we're spending in Afghanistan and Iraq make it impossible for us to have the quality of life here in America that we deserve and we are owed because it is our money?
Exactly. And Brother Washington, you bring up a great point, something that just triggered in my recollection when you bring up Eric Holder and Barack Obama, is yes, that if you could also, since you shed light on the case, because I know that there are a lot of our listeners who have emailed me today when they got the feeder out in terms of when the show was going to come on, and some of them emailed me letting me know that they had a very limited understanding on the Mumia case, and everything they've gotten was from the mainstream media.
Right.
If you can talk about so they can start to deconstruct these dominant narratives that are put out there, these lies.
Right.
Talk about some of the lies that are put out there on the other side. And I bring this up because you mentioned Obama, and we haven't heard a damn thing from Obama or Eric Holder about this. Despite the fact that this was, you know, this was one of the cases that was mentioned by the NAACP,
mm-hmm,
is that Obama had recently, well, about 2 months ago, he had lunch with a collection of journalists, and one of those journalists was this guy by the name of Michael Smirkanish, who was on Philadelphia radio, and
yeah,
who just recently penned a book with along with Faulkner's
widow.
Wife.
Yeah,
the
yeah,
widow.
Marine Faulkner, right. Yeah, and
he's
her attorney.
Exactly. And this thing has been, this book was promoted on MSNBC,
yeah,
CNN, every place. I saw when the book was first released, and they had him on, and, you know, Larry King and Chris Matthews had him on,
mm-hmm,
and they, you know, and gave him an opportunity to talk about the book and why he was so up in arms, and they had the widow on and all this kind of
mm-hmm
stuff. But yet, no one invites Lynn Washington to come on the show. No one invites, you know, somebody else that, you know, Noel Hammerhand to come on the show and to talk
yes
about the other side. So if you
mm-hmm
could talk about some of the lies and who this Smirkanish guy is, because he's obviously well known.
Okay, well, let me just debunk something right quick. Smirkanish is not a journalist. And for me to say that, or for any journalist to say that about another journalist, would tend to give an inference that we're being elitist or whatnot. We're not, all right? Smirkanish was a Republican political operative who, you know, through his own abilities and, you know, savvy, was able to get a radio show And then from there, he has risen up. So, you know, he set in for, what was it? He set in for Imus at one point.
Yeah.
You know, he deals with Glenn Beck. He's, you know, just a bosom buddy of Chris Matthews. So, you know, he's been able to, you know, pull some levers and pull himself up. You know, I don't begrudge him for getting up there, but, you know, this guy has a point of view, which is not bad, but, you know, let's not say that he is someone who is interested in an unbiased and objective analysis of the truth. You know, you're entitled to your own opinion. You're not entitled to your own facts. So let me give you a few facts about the Abu Jamal case. Number one, it is impossible for the police to frame Mumia Abu-Jamal. That's one of the biggest lies that are out there. Abu-Jamal was arrested in December of 1981. Between January and December of 1981 in Philadelphia, police arrested at least four people, charging them with three murders. Two for one murder, and then two individuals for other murders. All of them were open and shut cases, right? Just like Abu Jamal. Guilt is overwhelming. Open and shut. Okay, well, let's walk through this. In January of 1981, two men were arrested. One was a Hispanic man who couldn't speak English, and the other was a man who was mentally retarded. He had an IQ of 65. The Hispanic man allegedly provides a typewritten, single-space, perfect English confession. He can neither read nor write English, but he types up a confession. The mentally retarded man, well, you know, do we need to go down that line? The man's retarded.
Yeah.
These dudes ended up spending 18 years in jail until it was revealed that somebody else did the crime. They were framed by a police detective who was subsequently dead. Okay, so there's no getting back at him. One guy gets out, you know, no harm, no foul, no harm, no foul. You took 18 years of my life. And the other guy, the Hispanic guy, his lawyer wasn't sharp enough to negotiate the right deal. So when he came out of jail after spending falsely 18 years in Pennsylvania, they shipped him down to Florida to do some time for a case that was open at the time that he was framed in Philadelphia. Two guys. In May of 1981, there was a police officer, a black police officer. Oops, you never heard about this one, did you? A black police officer was killed by a sniper. They arrest an 18-year-old kid, open and shut case. They have an eyewitness, a co-defendant. When that case gets to trial the next year, good attorney argues the case. The kid gets off, walks clean. That murder of that black police officer remains unsolved today. In June of 1981, a mob murder in South Philadelphia. What's new about that? South Philly is where the mob operates,
right?
Two police detectives and a police sketch artist conspire over a six-week period to frame a guy named Neil Ferber. They arrest Neil Ferber. They put him on trial. There's this conspiracy to, you know, unduly influence eyewitnesses. The eyewitnesses only saw the killers for 3 seconds, and two of those 3 seconds were when they were looking at the people running away from them, not seeing the faces. But they framed Ferber. They got the police sketch artist to provide pictures saying that it was Ferber. Ferber was convicted. Spent 1,375 days on death row, ulcers, nervous breakdown, the whole bit. Fortunately for him, a police officer, a lieutenant, gets information from his from an informant that said that somebody else did it. He goes to the chief of police. The chief of police says, your job is to arrest people, not unarrest them. Get out of my office. He goes to the district attorney. They reinvestigate the case, find out that the guy is framed. Instead of letting him out, they retry him again. He gets off. He sues the city for framing him. And the city, in its scoundrelish ways, fights this suit, but the guy eventually gets $1.9 million out of the city. A judge that handled the appeal—I mean, you know—the legal case where he was trying to get paid for his framing says that what the guy endured was a Kafkaesque nightmare, more usually associated with totalitarian regimes, but it happened in America. So here in the same year that Abu-Jamal is arrested, we have four other men who documentably were framed by the Philadelphia Police Department in connivance with the Philadelphia prosecutors, the district attorney's office. So this notion that it is impossible to frame Abu-Jamal is a farce. It's a lie. Okay? Another thing that they say, well, Abu-Jamal never said anything. He's never said what happened that night. Well, listen, in America we have a thing called the Fifth Amendment that says you don't have to testify if you don't want to. And he's exercised that right, but he has always maintained that if he gets the opportunity to get back into the courtroom in a fair proceeding, not a proceeding before a judge who said he's going to fry out a nigger, he'll say what happened. But let's roll this back a little bit. After he was convicted, Abu-Jamal made a statement to the court. And in that statement, he declared his innocence on three separate occasions. And then in 2001, he issues an affidavit saying what happened. Now, you can question the contents of the affidavit because he just says, you know, I ran up, I was shot, and after that I don't know anything that happened. So you can contest what's in that affidavit, but you cannot then say that he's never said anything because he's filed an affidavit.
Exactly.
Okay. How many other lies do you want me to expose here? I know you each have a lot of questions, but I think those are the two core things that, you know, that there's no evidence that Abu-Jamal was framed. Well, there was plenty of evidence that he was framed, but I think contextually it shows people that this dynamic, this culture of framing people exists in Philadelphia and has persisted in Philadelphia. We have to, you don't understand, but just let me give you this little factoid, and, you know, we can move on to something else. Abu-Jamal is arrested in 1981. Police brutality is a core element in his case and a really a driving element in his conviction. In 1979, the U.S. Justice Department filed a suit against 21 officials in Philadelphia, including the mayor, a couple of his top aides, and then just about the whole command structure, the top command structure of the police department, charging them with aiding and abetting police brutality. This was the first time that the U.S. Justice Department had ever filed that kind of a lawsuit. Now, does one think that in 3 years everything was cleaned up? Absolutely not. So we have a history in Philadelphia of police abuse, and it manifested itself in the Abu-Jamal case, but it has manifested itself in so many other cases. It's sickening. It's absolutely sickening.
Absolutely. You just laid out very clearly some specific cases and those incidents and some incontrovertible facts about the corruption at a structural level and the systematic corruption in the system from the top to the bottom. So I want to ask you this question with regard to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling in January about the existence of racial bias in the criminal justice system as it has to do with the disenfranchisement of black felons. What's your take on that in terms of what impact, if any, it may have on that system in terms of how that's going to proceed? I can't see it not getting to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court actually going to have to make a ruling which is going to force the system to point the finger at itself and say, you know what, our system is corrupt, it is racist. Do you see that happening, or how do you see this resolving itself, and you see any real impact coming from this ruling?
Well, there's that little part of me that wants to be the eternal optimist, and I would like to say that it would have some impact, but the impact of the history in the United States would go to what you have just alluded to, that the system would be very reluctant to point the finger at itself. Listen, we have a Supreme Court, and it wasn't the conservative, reactionary, unethical crew that we have in there now, but about 10 years ago, the Supreme Court issued a ruling saying it is okay to execute an innocent person as long as the trial that they had was fair.
Mm-hmm.
Now, wrap your head around that.
Wow.
How can you have a fair trial and still convict an innocent person and put them on death row and execute them?
Exactly.
Right.
Now, would the system admit that it is racist to the core and that it has a big problem? No, it wouldn't. I mean, listen, look at the Senate right now, the U.S. Senate, okay? They're debating whether they should change and how should they change this crack cocaine outrage where, you know, they penalize crack cocaine at 100-to-1 disparity. The U.S. Sentencing Commission, the agency set up by Congress to make recommendations as to how Congress should rule in criminal matters, in 1995, told the Congress that there was a racially disproportionate impact of these crack cocaine laws and you need to get rid of them. It is now 2010, and they're still weaseling around with this while black men, black women, Hispanic men, and Hispanic women are languishing in prison on 5, 10, 15, 25-year sentences for the amount of crack cocaine that won't even fill the palm of your hand, and these are not dealers.
Right.
The 1995 U.S. Sentencing Commission report said that the vast majority of the people who are in prison for crack cocaine offenses are, number one, black, but number two are low-level users and sellers. Only 4% of the people that they had convicted at that point were classified as drug kingpins. And let's clean up another disparity. The predominant users of crack cocaine in America, according to the federal government's own statistics, are white folks.
Right.
However, the enforcement of this, and I'm not saying that people should run out and, you know, smoke a rock in a pipe. No, I ain't saying that. All right? But I'm saying if you're going to enforce the law, then enforce it equally, because that's what you say, you know, chisel and stone above the Supreme Court, equal justice under the law. Well, do that.
Right.
But you don't. That's why you have this overwhelming black presence in federal courts. When you look at the statistics, those whites that are arrested for crack cocaine, they're kept in the state court system where the penalties are lower, and also in the state court system where you don't have these mandatory minimums like you have in the federal system, although you do have some mandatory minimums. There's a lot more wiggle room. Most of these people end up in treatment.
Yeah.
Well, the folks end up in that prison industrial complex. So, you know, I guess the short answer, and I haven't given you a short answer, but the short answer here is that, yes, that was a really interesting, a really a truthful, revealing ruling that came out of the Ninth Circuit. Will it have a big impact? I don't think so. I absolutely don't think so.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. You brought up the you know, the crack cocaine scourge and the disparities in sentencing and so forth. So let me ask you, if you could help us connect some dots here, some of the dots that you just mentioned. The mass incarceration of people of color beginning in the early 70s, and then it exploded in the Reagan administration and then again in the Clinton administration. So that mass incarceration, the economic violence against black communities. For going back decades, the war on drugs, the proliferation of both handguns and these low-level drugs like marijuana in urban communities. Help us connect some of those dots and make some sense of some of these, you know, what might seem as random issues.
Okay, let's roll it back a few more decades prior to where you started at, and we'll come forward. There has always been a racial tint to drug enforcement in America. All right, after the Civil War, the predominant users of morphine and morphine in the United States were Civil War veterans who were amputees and things like that. And the second category was white women. Now, morphine comes from what? It comes from opium.
Right.
But when they lost the first drug war, it was against Chinese who they brought in to work on the railroads and do the laundries and stuff because they smoked opium. So you could buy morphine right over the counter in drugstores, but they were cracking down on the Chinese. At one point, you could buy cocaine over the counter in a drugstore. Coke, a cola, had cocaine in it.
Right.
Now, you talk about marijuana. The marijuana prohibition was passed in the 1930s. I can't even remember the exact date, but I don't want to stop the flow here to try to remember it. The person who put that together was a guy named Harry Anslinger. He was the head of the Bureau of Narcotics Enforcement or something like that. And he cast it in a racial tone. He said that marijuana is used predominantly by illegal Mexican immigrants. God, some things never change.
Illegal Mexican immigrants. We have to do something about them. They're taking our jobs.
And then they said it was black jazz musicians who were corrupting the morals of white people. There was a study done in New York City by then-Mayor LaGuardia about 3 years after the marijuana prohibition was put in place, and it found out that the persons who were arrested predominantly for marijuana was African-Americans.
Mm.
Now let's go up to the 60s, and before we go from the 60s into the 70s, let's remember something. There was something going on in Southeast Asia in the late 60s. It was called the Vietnam War. And what we found out later was that our government, and particularly the intelligence arms of our government, were in alliances with people who were making heroin in Southeast Asia. So our deal was, if you fight the Viet Cong, we'll let you do what you want to do with your heroin. And a lot of that heroin ended up on the streets of the United States. One of the, I guess the good thing and the bad thing about being a little old, you remember all this stuff. And I remember going to college in 1968, coming home, and my neighborhood in Pittsburgh, it was like the attack of the zombies, man. There were so many people just strung out on the corner. I mean, guys that I was in high school with. We never had heroin in the neighborhood. The heroin was so small. In fact, more people who were using, the few people who were using intravenous drugs, they were shooting prescription drugs because there wasn't any heroin around. All of a sudden, within months, there was a flood of heroin. Where did that come from? Well, it came from these schemes and deals between the intelligence agencies and drug dealers in Southeast Asia. In 1980s, when the Reagan administration was conducting their illegal war in Nicaragua, they made alliances with these Colombian drug dealers. The deal was, you can fly your drugs into the United States. When your planes fly back south to get more cocaine to bring into the United States, you take guns and weapons and medical supplies and boots and stuff like that to our Contras down there. Look at the parallels. At, you know, in South Central Los Angeles, where, you know, a lot of this cocaine started flooding in and you started getting, you know, the crack epidemic and stuff like that, all of a sudden you started seeing a proliferation of guns, right? Gang wars used to be with chains and a thing called zip guns. You know, people would take an aerial, a car antenna off and hollow it out and then put a little .22 bullet in it. And all of a sudden, these cats had full-auto AK-47s. Where did that come from?
Right.
Last time I checked, they don't make arms in Watts or Crenshaw or places like that, man.
Right.
So we have this economic devastation that's going on, right? Because in the late 60s, we had a thing called the War on Poverty, and it was an Office of Economic Opportunity. Well, when Nixon got in office, he sent two guys to dismantle this program that was actually empowering people who live in inner-city areas. People had jobs, public service jobs, but they had jobs. There were educational opportunities, there were scholarships. I mean, there were all kinds of things to try to uplift people. Now, they weren't going to touch the union seniority system that was based on discrimination, but we'll provide some other monies to people to help them to live so they, you know, can try to get a little toehold on the American dream. The two guys that Nixon sent over to dismantle the Office of Economic Opportunity, one guy was named Rumsfeld, Donald Rumsfeld, a former congressman who, as we know, subsequently became Bush, you know, Boy George Bush, his defense secretary. And then Rumsfeld hires a guy named Dick Cheney to be his assistant. You start to see all these connections now?
Yeah.
All right. In the 70s, we get this crackdown. We have to do something about crime. We have to crack down on crime. Were they talking about the Wall Street guys who were ripping people off back then? No. Were they talking about the defense contractors who were, you know, charging the government $600 for a hammer to pound a screw into an airplane wing? Of course, a screw, you need a screwdriver, but why would you need a hammer for it? But they were still charging us for it. No, they weren't going after that. We're going to, you know, crack down on these people in the ghetto. Listen, Pennsylvania, 1970s, prison population, about 5,000 people. Guess what the figure is today? It's nearly 50,000 people in jail in Pennsylvania. During the 1990s, Pennsylvania built 9 new prisons. Let me repeat that. Pennsylvania built 9 new prisons. In Philadelphia, they only built 1 new high school in the 1990s. So last year, was it 2 years ago, when this guy in the White House was campaigning, and there was a big ruckus about his minister being anti-American and anti-white.
Right.
What was Jeremiah Wright saying? We spend more money on prisons than we do on education. We spend more for prisons than we do on public housing. Well, Jeremiah Wright grew up in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
He knows what's going on. He's been in Chicago forever. He knows what's going on. It's the truth.
Right.
And nobody even dealt with that aspect of it. And this, and this gentleman in the White House, Mr. Obama, and look, I mean, you know, he's got a lot on his plate, and he's in a very unenviable position, but he wanted it. So now you got to do something with it, bruh. But, or should I say Mr. President, because let's not even make this a black and white thing, because some of the issues that he is ignoring are American issues. They don't have to do with black and white. It's just right and wrong.
Right.
Obama says, well, we got to do something about this race thing because I don't want white people hating me, so I'm going to give a big race speech. So I'm going to give a race speech where? Well, I'm going to give a race speech at the Constitution Center in Philadelphia, right across the street from Independence Hall. I mean, you can almost see the flags waving and the Constitution crinkling in the background, right? Well, that particular building was built without any black or Hispanic laborers or any black or Hispanic contractors. And the fact is that there were demonstrations during the building of that facility because of the racial exclusion there. Now, don't look in the newspapers for it because the white media didn't cover it. But you would think that a person who was giving a major speech on race, revealing the disparities of race that are underlying some of the problems today, they would notice that and make reference to that in their speech, but they didn't because most of their speech writers are white and don't know the realities that persons of color endure in this country.
Exactly. And quite frankly, they don't want to know.
They don't want to know. I mean, you know, it's life is fine. But we've been telling them, like coal mine canaries, that this thing cannot stand in the way it is in the inequitable distribution of resources and opportunities. And now, you know, I think since Katrina, we've had and I know a lot of people don't like this word, and, you know, when Marcus Garvey's organization issued a Declaration of Principles in, 1920 or 1921, they said, we don't want to hear this word nigger anymore. But as far as I'm concerned, there's been a niggerization of America since 2005. And, you know, I live out in the country. I live out in the suburbs. I see a lot of people, man, losing a whole lot of stuff. They're being treated like folks in the inner city are being treated. And they still don't see it. We're the problem.
I mean, there was a time in America not too long ago, well, actually before 9/11, 2001, where Arabs, when they came into the country, they were allowed to check off that they were honorary white people.
Yeah, not anymore.
Not anymore. You're right.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Let me shut up. Let you guys ask some questions.
And, I mean, I do have a question for you to connect the dots, but before you just brought up something, you know, when you talked about these folks, you know, in the rural areas, they're losing their jobs. And it's amazing. I was just telling Peter today, they were covering, I was watching the news coverage of this Tea Party, Tea Bag, or whatever movement. They had a huge protest today, mm-hmm. and it was covered by the media. And so they were interviewing this, and it wasn't, obviously wasn't U.S. media. I was actually watching, I believe it was Al Jazeera,
mm-hmm.
Because U.S. media wouldn't bring up the question that they end up asking this middle-aged white lady. She had a very strong southern drawl, and they asked her this question. They said, you know, why are you, you know, so, you know, why is this movement still going on strong and this and the other, you know, especially based around the fact that these huge corporations, you know, known as insurance companies, have been gouging people. You have the CEOs getting paid, you know, making these humongous windfall profits. Meanwhile, they're denying thousands and thousands and thousands of people of coverage,
mm-hmm.
Based around preconditions and this, that, and the other. And so she responded. Listen, you would have thought that, and I can't tell by, you know, I can't tell what her economic bracket is. But so she responded back in her strong, like, you know, southern drawl. She said, when did making profits become a bad thing in America? That was her response. So she starts, they're so mindless right now, and I think they rallied around this common cause that, yeah, there's a phenotypically, like, brown-skinned man in the White House, and I think they hate that, because you would have thought that these things would be as clear as day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of a commonality that they might have with folks on the left, you know, whether
right.
they be black, white, brown, or what have you. But her response was to, you know, was not to, like, say, yeah, that's right, you know, my grandpappy or my aunt or this, that, and the other in West Virginia or wherever has been denied, you know, coverage, this, that, and the other. No, it was to her gut reaction was to defend these CEO, these corporate CEOs who are getting tens of millions of dollars per year in
right.
profits, and that's not even including their stock options.
That's right.
So
those same – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no.
Well, what I was just going to say, those same people who she's defending their right to make profits will ride down the street in their chauffeur-driven limousines, roll down the window, and spit on a person like that. I mean,
right,
spit
right.
on them.
They're getting the beat.
America has an incredible ability and capacity to fake people out and make them go for the okie doke.
Right.
On this medical stuff you're talking about, okay? This
yeah,
summer,
right.
you know, last summer, you know, I saw that tea bag business, and you have these
yeah.
these senior citizen types there saying, "We don't want government involved, no social
yeah.
medicine." And are you on Medicare? Yes, I am.
Exactly.
Hey, don't touch it. Is Medicare a government program? No, you're trying to change the subject. No, we're trying to keep you on
yeah.
the subject.
Exactly.
All right? The
exactly.
American healthcare system, and this is where, you know, Obama's right, but, you know, the end result is wrong. The American healthcare system pulls out about 20% of all of the money, all of the profits, all of everything that's generated in this country, and it's been mushrooming for years. And there's a fear that it could get up to 30, 40, 50%.
Hmm.
People are not, the country cannot sustain that. Now, the interesting thing is that during the Bush administration, those folks were fleeced, okay? Not the Bernie Madoffs, but the structural theft that came in with these mortgage derivative instruments and all this other crazy stuff that they came up with, you know, allowing them to offshore stuff, and these obscene tax breaks that only went to the upper 1% of society. Now, you know, I said 1% of society, the upper 1%. I didn't say black society or white society. So the reality is that the majority of those teabaggers were the ones who got it in the rear end from those tax cuts. They didn't say anything on that. If we stop the war in Iraq and Afghanistan tomorrow, we could take care of all of the deficits that we have in the states that are causing, you know, services to be cut. Hey, listen, and I live in New Jersey, and they just elected a Republican governor, and we're going to cut taxes, and we're going to cut property taxes, and so on and so forth. He's named office now. He's saying there'll be no tax rebates on your on your property taxes. Ain't giving you guys nothing because things are so bad. Yeah, well, they were bad, and you lied to get in, but even more than that, because you expect politicians to not be truthful, i.e. lie, but it's the public that goes for that okey-doke, and these people go for the okey-doke all the time. Let me just say one last thing on this point. 1890s, middle to 1890s, there's a recession in the country. Serious recession in the country. And black folks and white folks at the bottom of the totem pole start looking at each other and say, hey, wait a minute, we're both getting jerked here. Why don't we work together? So there was a thing going on at the time called a populist movement. And blacks and whites started getting together, and those at the top said, oh, wait a minute, we can't have this kind of unity in working together. What happened was they hatched Jim Crow. So they said to the poor white man, well, listen, you don't have any money, and no, you'll never be a Vanderbilt or a Rockefeller, but you'll be better than that colored man over there, so we'll give you separate water fountains and separate toilets and separate entrances. And these white folks bought it. They bought it hook, line, and sinker, man.
Right.
You know, and while they were lynching black folks, they were shooting, you know, union organizers down like they were dogs in the street.
Exactly.
And we still don't see it as a
country. You're right. And that's an excellent segue to my next question that ties into, you know, let's talk about another socialized, you know, since these, you know, nitwits don't kind of understand like that they do receive, you know, various items from their government. Mm-hmm. Local and state and federal that are socialized, such as police, and so I want to talk about it to create connections between the MOVE case,
mm-hmm.
You know, going back to the late 70s. So if you can give us like a brief biographical sketch of what happened, who were the MOVE. Who were the MOVE Nine, what happened, and also, you know, because I think this would be a great way to bring things home is to compare and contrast, you know, because we know that it was, unfortunately, a lot of us have brought into, you know, you were talking about a lot of white folks have brought into okey-doke, and you know, Obama's campaign was, you know, it was ranked, it was awarded, like, by the Cannes Lions something festival that was held as the number one media campaign of 2008. And a lot of us bought into that, you know, and what I mean by that is, I mean, black folks bought into this fact that in this reality, which is not a fact, that somebody phenotypically black is just intrinsically going to serve their best interests. And that's not the case. And
mm-hmm.
so when we look at 1985, we saw – It was a black man that was Mayor Wilson Good, and he ordered the bombing, the wholesale bombing of that house that took out a couple blocks, and I bring him up because if you can, as you talk about the MOVE Nine, the case, 1984-85, if you can bring it home to right now in Philadelphia, the place that you work, the place that you've done a lot of work. You know, the past few decades, you have another black mayor, Michael Nutter, and now
mm-hmm.
you have a district attorney,
mm-hmm.
Seth Williams, I believe his name is.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts? you can close out, and you can take it in whatever order. What are your thoughts on Seth Williams? What are your thoughts on Michael Nutter? And what are your thoughts on on their new approach to crime in Philadelphia, because a couple of years ago, Philadelphia was the murder capital of the U.S. I don't know what it was last year, but it's still a major, major problem.
Right.
You know, so, yeah.
Oh, God. So I start at the back and work forward in the front. Well, let me start at the back because you raised the issue of MOVE. MOVE is and was an organization that is against everything that the system is for. So let me just leave it at that. They came into being, or at least became public, in around 1972. And one thing about MOVE is that they don't back down. Now, that's a good thing in one sense, but a bad thing in another, because they were disruptive not only to the system, but they made war on black people. But that's a whole other thing. So now MOVE comes out, starts, you know, spreading its ideology and, you know, trying to get people to, you know, listen to what they're saying. They immediately run into a clash with the then mayor, a guy named Frank Rizzo, who was a real racist dog. He sticks the police department on him, and, you know, where usually the police would, you know, just come out and beat somebody down, well, MOVE fought back. And they were, you know, they were giving beat downs as much as they were getting them. That leads to an incident in 1978 where MOVE is barricaded into a house. The city comes in, shoots up the place. A police officer is slain in this confrontation. The MOVE members, at this point, there's nine of them huddled up in a basement. They're shooting, or allegedly shooting, out of a basement window from standing back from the window. So they're underground. They're below grade level. They're shooting upwards, right? This police officer was shot in the back with the bullet going downward. So unless it was one of them John F. Kennedy bullets, it was unlikely that that bullet came from a MOVE gun, even if MOVE was shooting. Those nine persons that were brought out of the house, and there were a few more brought out, but I'm not going to get into that, they were sentenced to terms of 30 to 100 years. Now, the judge who presided over the case, and it was a tactical mistake on MOVE's part to go for a bench trial as opposed to a jury trial, and also to put the system on trial as opposed to getting their own behinds off. The judge said, I don't know who did what. Because the testimony from police officers was that there was only one weapon that killed the police officer, and the only weapons that were seen in the hands of MOVE were in the hands of the four men. The five women down there, they said, were holding babies. So the judge says, I don't know who did what, but you came in here as a family, I'm going to sentence you as a family. All of you Negroes get 30 to 100 year sentences. Now, MOVE now tries to get their members out of jail because they feel that they were falsely incarcerated. A very compelling argument, but given, you know, the tenor of the times, nobody was listening to it, not even the black mayor. Now, you know, I'm a little jaundiced about, you know, the euphoria over Obama, because I've seen black mayors come in all over the country, and I've seen so many dashed hopes in terms of what was expected of them and what wasn't, and what actually turned up. One of the impetuses that brought people to the polls to elect Wilson Good was to do something about police brutality in Philadelphia, right? Remember 1979, U.S. Justice Department lawsuit, because during the 70s, Philadelphia police shot and killed more people on a daily basis than in New York City, and New York City was 12 times larger than Philadelphia at the time.
Damn.
Okay? So Wilson Good, when he comes in, instead of saying, look, I'm going to deal with this police brutality stuff, what does he try to do? He becomes a Kool-Aid brother, and he's going to make friends. So he's going to make friends with the police department. So instead of shaking up the police department, he hires a commissioner from inside the department, and that was the dude who ordered a bomb dropped on MOVE in 1985. They had an all-day shootout. They blew off the front of the house. And then about 5:30 in the afternoon, they dropped a bomb on top of the house, knowing that there were four to a bomb, right? They called it an entry device. But when you put C4 plastic military explosives in it, along with Tovex, which is an explosive that they put in coal mines and other mines to blow holes in there, and they had a couple of other things in there, and then the police commissioner says, spike it with shrapnel. They drop it on the roof. There's a five-gallon can of gasoline up on the roof that they knew it. A fire starts. So the police commissioner says, well, okay, the bomb didn't blow a hole in the roof. Here's the theory. We drop the bomb on the roof. The bomb makes a hole in the roof, and it also takes care of the bunker that MOVE has up there, because they feel that, you know, if MOVE was in this bunker, you know, like this is like World War II, and there's, you know, like the Germans and the Japanese, you know, that's kind of foolishness. So since the bomb didn't blow a hole in the roof, so we couldn't run across the rooftops and drop tear gas into the house, although they had blown the front of the house off in the morning, they could have fired tear gas right into the front of the house, we will let the fire burn. We will let the fire serve as a tactical weapon to drive the MOVE people out of the house. Well, the fire did drive the MOVE people out of the house, but police snipers drove them back in. This is what the testimony was. Police officers were out there with weapons from M16 weapons to 50 caliber to 30 caliber machine guns, and they also had ultra sophisticated 22 250 sniper rifles that had silencers on them. And they said, well, why did you have a silencer on this rifle? They said, well, listen, we may have had to shoot out street lights so to make things dark. Well, if you shoot out a street light, you're going to hear the glass breaking. So why do you need a silencer? They let the fire burn. The fire goes from the MOVE house to the adjoining houses across the street. Before it's all done, they burn up 2.5 blocks, burn down 61 homes, leave 250 middle-class black folks with nothing but the clothes on their back, and they killed 11 MOVE members, including 5 children. Now, one would say, well, what happened after that? Well, the only two people who went to jail behind that was the lone surviving adult MOVE member, Ramona Africa, and then they brought in a contractor. Now, here's where, you know, this black political stuff gets real slimy. There was an effort to rebuild the houses, okay? So there was a coalition of black contractors from that section of the city, West Philadelphia. There were two other major white contractors. And then there was an unusual collaboration of a black contractor who had a very checkered record. I mean, he had been run out of Atlantic City and a few other places in Jersey, you know, like one step away from the, you know, getting arrested for, you know, shenanigans. He goes in business with a woman who runs a public marketing firm, has no construction business at all. He gets the money. The first thing he does with the money is buy a Jaguar. The second thing he does is take his girlfriend down to the Bahamas. So he gets arrested and convicted. Those are the only two people that went to jail. There was a grand jury investigation. The grand jury came back with the conclusion that the police didn't do anything wrong, even the police who were caught lying to the grand jury. They claimed that no one went out there with criminal intent to do any harm, and they were authorized because there were a few misdemeanor warrants that they were serving. This thing, the whole MOVE thing from 1972 up to current times, has cost the city of Philadelphia in excess of $100 million. And the bottom line issue here was what was called double standards of justice, where some people get the book thrown at them, and other people, they get a pass, you know, a get-out-of-jail-free pass. And that dynamic of double standards of justice are still going on, not just in the MOVE case, but in so many other cases. And I think that's an encapsulation of the MOVE saga in Philly.
Right. Do you see any what are your thoughts on the current mayor and the current DA in Philadelphia?
Well, I see quite a metamorphosis of folks when they get in certain positions. The current mayor, Michael Nutter, was the person commendably, as when he was serving city council, he fought the then mayor, a guy named Ed Rendell, who's now the governor of Pennsylvania. And interestingly enough, Ed Rendell was the district attorney during the two MOVE things, including the bombing, and he fought a grand jury being formed, and he was the DA when Mumia was convicted and put on death row. But Michael Nutter got a civilian police review board in place. So, you know, before he becomes mayor, he sees police brutality. After he becomes mayor, he doesn't see any police brutality. He brings in a guy from out of town, a guy named Charles Ramsey, to be the police commissioner. Mr. Ramsey was in Chicago and in Washington, D.C. According to some people in those cities, he was not responsive to misconduct and abuse by police. He's now running the place. Nutter campaigned that he was going to have a stop and frisk. We're going to take care of these people together. We're going to cut down on crime. Any black person we see, you know, with baggy pants on, we're going to, like, go through their pockets. Well, please, I mean, that ain't the way you're supposed to do stuff, but they were doing that. Seth Williams is the DA now. He was a former assistant district attorney. The guy talks all the right stuff, but, you know, it just remains to be seen what he's going to do while he's in office. He just got in office in January. Have the activities of the police commissioner and the mayor actually reduced crime? Well, yes, crime has gone down. Well, let me put it this way. Homicides have gone down. But see, the one thing that always kind of like hits me in the gut is that there are people in the communities, mothers groups, men's groups, who patrol these streets at night, talking to these folks, trying to help them out, trying to cut down on the violence. They get no credit at all. And, you know, you can't, as our former police commissioner in Philadelphia, a guy named Sylvester Johnson, I mean, he was very fond of saying, you can't arrest your way out of these problems. And what we see locally, statewide, and nationally is this preponderance of doing the same thing the same way, which is, you know, we'll arrest our way out of it, we'll fill up the prisons, and if we fill them up too much, we'll build new prisons. In Philadelphia today, the annual budget is $3 billion. One-third of that, $1 billion plus, goes to the prison system in Philadelphia, not the state, just in Philadelphia. The prisons, it's the police, the prisons, and the courts, and the DA. Right off the top, $1 billion. Now, let's think about this. Most of the people who are in jail don't have educations. Many of them don't even have high school degrees. So if you improve the educational system, then you could cut down on crime. This is not rocket science. This is a proven fact. But we don't have the money to improve the schools because we're paying $1 billion for law enforcement.
Right.
If you have schools, but you have kids going from their home to schools, walking through communities that look like Baghdad or Beirut, I don't care what you give them inside those schools. When they come out and see that foolishness, when they're walking home ducking bullets and, you know, walking around crackheads and all that kind of stuff, it's going to have an impact on them.
Right.
But we don't have money to deal with those problems because we're putting $1 billion into law enforcement. And, you know, when you say stuff like that, oh, that's that bleeding heart liberalism business. No, this is fact. We know this stuff works. You folks have decided that you don't want it to work, and now you're in a pickle. California is going bankrupt because, in large part, look at the money that they're putting into the prison system.
Right.
They spend more money on prison guards' salaries than they do for teachers. And they're laying off teachers in California, but they're not laying them off the prison guards.
Right.
We've got ourselves into a big mess here.
Yeah, we hear that regressive mantra that, you know, we can't solve the problems of education by throwing money at it. But yet and still, they certainly seem more than willing to throw money in catastrophic amounts, on issues of so-called security. You know, they have no problem throwing large amounts of money into the prison industrial complex, into the security complex, into law and order, and so on and so forth.
Right.
So that's just a stark contradiction.
Listen, we put all this money into security, right? Radiation detectors and facial recognition software and profiling. But you can't stop an idiot getting on an airplane with withdrawals made out of explosives.
Right.
I mean, duh. 9/11 was supposedly a problem between the FBI and the CIA not talking to each other and allowing those alleged terrorists to be in the country and to get on an airplane, or should I say get on three airplanes, allegedly. And then now we supposedly have our system in place, and we now have the Department of Homeland Security that can't secure New Orleans and other places. That's another topic. And you still let this little idiot get on a plane. Listen, I've flown out of Amsterdam, man, and they have stopped me at the gate because I had a bottle of wine in a checked bag. They came to the gate, man, and said, we're looking for Lynn Washington. Man, I went petrified, you know?
Yeah.
What are you looking for? Do you have anything in your bag? Do I have anything in my bag? Yeah, I got stuff in my bag. That's why it's in my bag. That wine. Yeah, a friend of mine gave me some wine. Oh, okay. You packed it? Yeah, I packed it. I put it in there because I couldn't carry it on a plane with me. I can't take more than 3 ounces on an airplane. And they let a guy with explosive underwear on a plane
bought the ticket in cash, had been pointed out by his father on more than one occasion to the embassy. I mean, come on, that whole thing stinks. You know, really
and of course, in the ghetto, we're going to enforce responsibility. They have a thing going on in Philadelphia now where they're trying to pass a law where a parent can be put in jail if their kid does something wrong.
Wow.
Okay, so we're going to enforce maximum responsibility on those folks. But all of these people who make all of these mistakes, be it in the security, intelligence area, or be it on Wall Street or the big banks or the big insurance companies, none of them mugs are in jail.
Right.
None of them mugs are in jail.
Why not? They're too big to fail.
Oh, yeah, they're too big to fail and apparently too big to go in jail. And listen, we're not asking them to go into the maximum security places. Send them to, you know, club feds, you know, where they play tennis or something. But, you know, show some accountability.
Right.
And you don't think that, you know, the little knuckleheads out on the corner don't see that disparity where the big guys get off and we get a foot up our backside? And then you want us to respect what? We ain't respecting this. You don't respect me. I'm not going to respect you. Now, I'm not justifying it. I'm just telling you that this is the way it happens. And if we think it's going to happen some other kind of way, we must be have gone to Amsterdam and smoked something. I don't know.
Exactly. And speaking of accountability, I mean, I think that one of the, even though a lot of the folks that were the framers of this so-called Constitution were, were slave owners, and you know this thing was not designed to be a democracy. But one of the things that they did place an emphasis on was the media and the role that the media plays in an informed, you know, in terms of informing the populace and so forth and therefore creating a greater democracy. And you know it was
right.
You know, James Madison said that, you know, without a diversified popular media, you know, it's the prelude to a farce or perhaps worse. And I'm no big fan of James Madison, the slave owner, you know, by any means, but that made a lot of sense. And the question I guess the last question I want to ask you, you know, before we go off air, is that you being a journalist, we've seen like the news media, and I put news in quotations, the news media, now we see more and more newspapers, you know, going out of business or going online, like the Seattle Post Intelligencer, and we see the media becoming more and more consolidated. We saw like what happened with the 1996 Telecom Act, you know, what that did with small radio in general, decreased black ownership of radio by 70% within like 3 years.
That's amazing.
And big time. And so now, you know, we're looking at a corporate media where we have, you know, four or five corporate media outlets basically controlling the lines here, the vast majority, over 90% of the information that the average person intakes. My question to you being a journalist, what,
you know, what do you see the future is with in terms of media in this country? You know, what are you what are the things that concern you? Because I know you still write for the Philadelphia Tribune and some other outlets.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How can, because we, you know, I keep telling folks, because you know, sometimes people, you know, they let their ignorance, and we all have ignorance, you know, but it's to me, the smartest people in the world understand that they recognize their ignorance, and that's what propels them to continue to seek out answers and more information about things. And so I have people that they will say, Solomon, why are you, you know, talking about the, you know, about what NBC or CNN or Fox News owns this. I'm like, you fool. You own the airwaves. You
right.
own. Your tax dollars pay for that. Their big money pays for the infrastructure and the towers, but you own that. So don't tell me that this is something that doesn't matter. It does matter. It's because of this why we're in these two or three wars that we're engaged in. If you want to include Pakistan, it's why, you know, the prison industrial complex is not, you know, something that is discussed on the tongues of people in America, let alone within the inner cities, in terms of having a concrete critical analysis of the situation that you laid out, you know, in this show. So, you know, what I mean, you've got to be frustrated, Lynn. But what do you see? How do you see it changing?
Well, you're right. I'm very frustrated. I'm getting quite disillusioned as being a journalism professor, teaching people to go into this profession that I know is corrupt thoroughly. Many times when I'm working, I feel like I need to put on surgical gloves because this business is so slimy. You talked about the First Amendment and the Freedom of the Press Clause. Well, the Freedom of the Press Clause was inserted in the First Amendment in large part, because the framers of the Constitution, you know, slaveholders et al., knew that for democracy to work, there had to be that phrase you mentioned, the informed electorate. So the media was supposed to provide information. But the media was also supposed to do something else, and that was to be a watchdog on government, okay? Our government is set up, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. Each of them has checks and balances, powers, but who checks the checkers? Well, that was supposed to be the press, to keep an eye on all of those rascals. And the media today, the corporate media, has been derelict in that. The reason that we're in Iraq is because they pushed the lies and they didn't check things out. When Colin Powell went to the United Nations with his little dog and pony picture show saying, you know, this is here and that's there and such and that, the American media just bought it hook, line, and sinker. People in England, they went to those places in Iraq and said, excuse me, you say that there's a biological weapons plant here? There's two raggedy, rusted-out trailers. There's nothing in them. You know?
Right.
I mean, the media is not doing its job. Now, where's the media going? Well, you know, if I had that crystal ball and I knew where that was going, I could probably make a lot of money because nobody really knows what's going on. But I could tell you one thing that I'm sincerely, to the bottom of my heart, sure of, is that, yes, the Internet has had a tremendous tremendous negative impact on newspapers, definitely, and television to a lesser degree. But the problem was just not the Internet. I think that there are two other factors that are going on here that a lot of people are not looking at, and particularly those who put themselves in positions of being observers and scholars of this media. Number one, from the late 80s out, Wall Street said, oh, these media outlets are making a lot of money. They're making 17, 25, 30% profit. We need to get involved in trying to get some of that money. So that's when you started having corporate money coming in. So a lot of these family-owned TV stations, and well, not so much TV stations because they were pretty much corporatized by that point, but newspapers, they started becoming a part of these big chains. And these, you know, the market, the shareholders, they bled these places dry, man. You know, laying off people, closing foreign bureaus, that whole thing. Parallel to that, there has always been a problem in the white media about covering persons other than white people. And I remember back in the 80s, man, when I was working for the white media here in Philadelphia, we was telling them, listen, man, you guys, it's not only the right thing to do to provide coverage and accurate coverage of minority communities, it's a marketing thing. Okay? These people will buy your paper. But they ignored them. They ignored them. They decided to run out to the suburbs, and the people in the suburbs, they got their own little papers. They don't need, you know, a metropolitan newspaper. So they lost on two accounts. And now, you know, what one of the biggest trends is in the news media, and particularly the newspaper media, is a thing called hyperlocal. They now want to do community news in the inner city. That train has left, Bub. And, you know, on the one hand, it's like, you know, good for you. You racist, ignorant folks.
Yeah.
However, it has a detriment to our democracy, our country. And for me personally, it's a detriment because that's my gig. You know?
Yeah.
So it's crazy, but, you know, it's one of these things that was foreseeable. And those folks who are qualified, who criticize affirmative action and all the other stuff, you know, and now they're suffering the consequences of it. And even today, with the proliferation of the Internet, there are still people running newspapers and TV stations that don't understand that we live in a multimedia landscape now and are fighting that. In fact, I got to fight with my doggone students every day to get them to understand that this is a multimedia world. And listen, you know, what I did 30 years ago by, you know, coming in with a camera and a pencil and paper, and then I had to give up the camera because I wasn't in the photographer's union, I could just keep the pencil and paper, you can't do that anymore. You got to know video. You have to know how to write. You have to know how to shoot still pictures, and you have to know how to, you know, do digital audio, and then you have to know how to put all of that on the web. But they don't want to hear that. Well,
right.
That's their piece. You know?
Right.
Yeah, so anyway, that was a long answer to your short question.
And I appreciate it, and I appreciate your time. I wish we had another hour, but we're up against the clock right now, and I just want to thank you so much for coming on our show, and I'm glad you mentioned that point that you just did in terms of your closing comment because, you know, as you know, this is progressive media and getting the word out to our community has always been a part of our DNA in terms of us of African ancestry. It's always been a part, whether it was the
drums or the griots or whatever.
From Sam Corners or John Rushworm, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know,
let's not forget Ida Wells Barnett.
Yep.
Crusader. Had a notebook in one hand and her pistol in the other, man.
Exactly. And even David Walker's appeal. I mean, that was a form of journalism. That was getting the word out, you know?
Yep, absolutely.
So I just, you know, I really want to thank you so much. And, you know, I don't know if there's an email address that you might want to give out just in case there are some, you know, listeners that might want to.
Well, if anybody wants to get in touch with me, they could, you know, I teach at Temple University, so you can just go on the website. I mean, so, if, you know, if you want to get in touch with me, you can work a little bit, and then you can find out who I am and how to get in touch.
Definitely do it, because I did the work. That's how I found it. So, it's just a pleasure, and I look forward to just exchanging a lot of ideas.
Okay, well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Brother Washington,
great questions,
thank you very much.
And, you know, I'm always available. I talk for free.
and we need that. We need your information.
Cool.
We need your information. So thank you so much again.
Okay, man. Good
appreciate
enough.
You
all right,
care.
All right. Right. Yeah. Good night
take
to
care,
you and your listeners. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And Peter, I'm going to take us out right now with a song, a classic. I think you're gonna like The Last Minute. And so, Peter, I'll see you. I'll see you next week.
All right,
we'll do this again. Same black time, same black channel.
We got it. All right.
All right.
Peace and all right.
We are Africans, and we happen to be in America.
Face for your face, London. Everybody in the house, make some noise. I want everybody in the house to say, ho! Yo, Chuck, kick it to him, man.
A ballad behind bars, or you could say real rock from the rock. An unusual musical happening in a most unusual place. The state prison.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army over. The suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in my cell. How long has it been? They got me sitting in a state pen. I gotta get out, but that thought was thought before. I contemplated a plan on the cell floor. I'm not a fugitive on the run, but a brother like me's begun to be another one. Tell the enemy serving time to drew the line, y'all. They criticize me for some crime. Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man and I can never be a veteran. On the strength of situations unreal, I got a raw deal. So I'm looking for the steal.
Hey, yo, Chuck, are you serious? You in the Justice Plan?
Word them up. I'm looking for that steal.
Yo, man, we gonna break you out of there, man. We ain't gonna like that, man.
Don't you know they got me rotten in the time that I'm serving? Telling you what happened the same time they're throwing. Four of us packed in a cell like slaves. Oh, well, the same motherfucker got us living in his hell. You have to realize what is the four.